Now we can see a new world coming into view, a world in which there is a very real prospect of a new world order.
The new world order does not mean surrendering our national sovereignty.
Resistance Radio calling, and this is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, right here in the bunker, right here in North Central Indiana, where it's a little bit chilly today, but not too bad. A lot of wind, though. Yeah. I was out there mowing my yard, and boy, I was chopping those leaves up, and they were flying about a block. How about that? Hey, we're at Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. I want to thank you all for getting your donations in for the radio show. That helps out a lot. And I just finished getting those money orders out. I think it was last week I said I was getting them out. I finally got them out. And I talked to Richard Scutari last night on the telephone, and he's doing okay considering he's in the clink down there in Pollard, Louisiana. But one of these days he's going to get out, and we'll have a party, okay? And it is October the 6th, 2014. I see that Matt Hale is doing some more legal work trying to get out of that joint, federal joint. And he's also writing a, has either written or writing a book. And so he's busy. David Tate down in Missouri, he's doing okay. He's a little upset because they changed the way you give them money down there. You got to get a little slip and fill it out before you can send them money. So anyhow, he sent me two or three slips, so that'll keep me going for a few weeks here. Otherwise, he's doing fine. And who else? Oh, Mr. Loeb Jr. down there in Florida. He's in a real bad prison down there. And he wrote me two letters, big, long letters. I haven't even finished them yet. But he's doing fairly well, considering that Florida's got some of the worst prisons in the country. So cheap down there that if they put you in an electric chair, they send you a bill for the electricity. You know, I listen to a lot of partial radio shows, if they're interesting. And you might be surprised, sometimes I listen to a black show. There's one guy on there that he's obviously a black, moderate black racist. Everybody, every black person is his brother, all that kind of stuff. But he does a pretty good job of being common sense about things. And he sure understands the cops on the street and the harassment. Well, he's on from 6 o'clock till 10 o'clock in the morning, Eastern Standard Time. His name is Joe Madison. Now, don't get excited. He's not going to tell you you're wonderful or I'm wonderful. But still, there's a lot of good information on his show. And also to sort of listen into what the rank and file blacks are thinking. This morning he had a very good show. It's a show where a cop, I forget where he said it was, stopped this black guy and his wife and his little baby, and they started to go to work on him. They didn't have any probable cause or any reason to be stopping him or holding him. But this guy, he had a camera, and he had a sound recorder and camera, and he got it all. And Madison played it on his show today. It was very interesting. If I get a hold of it, I'll play it for you. But he handled the way I'd like to see white guys handle it. And some white guys do handle it that way. But he really gave those cops a hard way to go. And now it's going to go to court and go to a jury trial. So, but anyhow, Joe Madison, and don't email me and say, well, he's a black racist. Well, of course he's a black racist. Also, they had on there about Fox TV put out this deal from Louis Farrakhan's paper, Final Call. I did get it, but I got so behind on reading him and I quit it. One of our supporters was sending it to me. But he was going on and on about the Ebola being an invention of the West and the white man to limit the numbers of the blacks in Africa and so forth, which, to be perfectly honest, is not a bad idea. But I will say this, that I don't trust Mr. Farrakhan anymore. Well, I never could really trust him anymore. He could trust me, but ever since he went to tour Africa and went down with Muammar Gaddafi, and when he came back or was going to come back, the State Department threatened him that they were going to throw him in jail. I got the distinct, and he changed his attitude quite a bit since then. And I got the distinct impression that the boys might have got to him. Another one of those CIA-type operations. Maybe. I can't say for sure. But just like in the right wing, they've got CIA-controlled operatives. everybody says FBI. Well, FBI, yes, so somewhat. But I say CIA is the one that really gets in there and does some real skullduggery. But anyhow, my opinion is that Farrakhan was scared into going along with the CIA about 15, 20 years ago. And if he's not, I apologize. But I got a distinct impression, suspicion, that he did. Now, why would he be pushing this Obala as a white man's invention? Well, there could be several reasons. We get the same kind of stuff on the right wing. Of course, that was read on television by Scott Fox TV right off his newspaper. So we know Fox TV serves the beast. There's no doubt about that. So who's on first, who's on second, and who's on third? It's hard to figure out anymore. But I'm telling you, anybody that's got a big budget and got the ear of thousands of people, or got big radio shows and all that kind of stuff, and they got money coming in, watch out. Watch out! Most of the people who tell the truth have a hard time paying their bills. I want to read you the intro, and I don't think I did this before, on Carlos Whitlock Porter, who lives over in Belgium, I believe, put out this new book called Satires, S-A-T-I-R-E-S. And it's not a big, thick book, but it's a very good book. It's about 130 pages. This is the introduction. Many years ago, someone I know very well worked as a trained children's nurse in a world-famous hospital for disturbed children in London. With 4 years of training, RN, RSCN, and about 8 years of experience, all the other staff members were simply qualified, similarly qualified. The head of the unit was obviously a qualified physician with 20 years of experience working with disturbed children. One day, two Jews showed up, both of them 22 years old, one from South Africa, the other from Canada. Neither one of them with any medical training or experience, but with 4 years psychological degrees. They created total chaos throughout the entire hospital from the day they arrived until the day they left. They said that the children should be allowed to express themselves by refusing to do what they were told, by hitting and kicking members of the staff, by spitting on members of the staff, and so on and so on. Sounds like Dr. Spock, huh? If you didn't agree with what they said, you were accused of not wanting to be progressive, and so on and so on. They would argue the hind leg off a mule and were adept at proving that 2 plus 2 equals 4. The English being what they are, a bit wishy-washy, in short order, these two Jews had everybody fighting and quarreling with everybody else. The doctor in charge of the unit simply opted out. In the end, after several months, they both left, presumably to wreak havoc somewhere else, and things returned more or less to normal. This is how the Jews always operate, at all times and in all places. They get everybody fighting with each other over crazy theories invented by them, and it only stops when they leave or are expelled. This has been the history of the Jews for 3,000 years, wherever they have ever lived, from the distant past to the present. That repression causes neurosis is a truism of the modern world, a notion invented and peddled chiefly by Jews and originally, but not exclusively, by the Freudians. Don't forget that Edward Bernays, who taught American manufacturers how to con the public in this country, was the grandson of Freud. You need to read about Bernays. He was something else. Good manners, discretion, a decent sense of shame, a consideration for the feeling and sensitivity of others are a thing of the past. This applies chiefly to sexual matters. This does not apply, of course, to the repression of our natural resentment of Budinsky, Yidniks, and other byproducts of the primeval ooze. What about our self-expression? What about our mental health? We should bust a gut or something. We might become neurotic already. It is the hypothesis of this practitioner, myself, that millions of white Americans are suffering from neurotic symptoms caused by repression of their racial feelings. Freud believed that neurosis would cure itself through the catharsis of analysis, i.e., the expression of repressed feelings, hence the present volume. And that's where the book goes on from there. I think he hasn't sent me where I should get the book from or how much. I know I gave him permission to use our A. Wyatt Man cartoons. I gladly, and so there's quite a number of those in the book. I've got to find out where in the hell to find get the book, because he's in Belgium and I'm here. And you're there. I think I mentioned it the other day that I had an appointment, was given an appointment to the Veterans Administration, VA. And yeah, I believe I did tell you, but I drove, you know, about 50 miles round trip. And when I got there, they called my name, and I went in this office, and some guy I'd never seen before was in there. And actually, the more I got to thinking about this after a few days, I'm wondering whether they didn't slip one in on me there, trying to do a little interrogation. I'm not a real paranoid kind of person. Most of you know that, I hope. Not like the average right winger that every time he hears a click on his telephone, he thinks he's being tapped. But that was a strange situation. And then a casual conversation, either by an expert or just a casual conversation. Well, it rose my suspicions enough. I think I'm going to go back to my family doctor and leave the VA alone. Well, I see a short one here. Ebola now threatens the Liberian culture, where churchgoers often hold hands while singing and kiss from cheek to cheek. Uh-oh, there goes the neighborhood. Well, I guess Nicolas Cage, well, he's probably got a contract that he gets the money no matter what, but this new movie, Left Behind, I looked at it and I was suspicious of it, and it's this, all the Christians, believers, are going to be swept up into the sky, man. And Nicolas Cage's Left Behind opened in sixth place with an estimated 6.9 million, which is very, must have been all the Christians, compared to the other faithism film, The Good Lie, opening at an estimated 935,000. I guess they don't want that religious stuff there, man. I love the pagan stuff. Yeah, more and more pagan stuff, and that's good. And the Harvard Divinity School has introduced an all-gender restroom. Yay for Harvard! Well, Wheaton College, I forget where that's at, will host a dedication ceremony for its reinstallation of a grave marker of an abolitionist. Boy, I'll tell you, we got to do that, man. Well, Jews on American campuses from coast to coast are trying to wake up Americans to be aware that violent anti-Judaism is spreading plague. But the students are a weak voice, living in fear and asking, never again. The Jewish Voices on campus, Aaron Goldenberg, posted a video this week of the Legal Insurrection website that exposes widespread hate and violence that have become a commonplace, so commonplace that, in the words of one California student, it is expected. The Jewish press this past year has published dozens of reports of racist and violent anti-Judaism, including here, 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 and here. The reaction of American Jewish leaders, let alone non-Jews, has been zero effect. Even worse, there is no lack of American Jews totally detached from Israel. Yeah. Most Jews totally feel totally detached from Israel and from Judaism. who throw fuel on the fire of hate by damning Israel for its very existence. It is totally un-American even to suggest that the United States is not a freedom-loving country. It is not acceptable to think aloud that Nazism could dominate America. The American psyche still imaging that God, Mom, and apple pie are foundations of the country cannot even consider that the radical Muslim revolution in Europe has sown its seeds of hate and anarchy in the land of the free and the home of the brave. Wow. Jews on campus are afraid to be brave. The same goes for Canada, where a University of Calgary student says he is paranoid and sometimes afraid to walk by himself on campus. Being against Israel has become the cool thing to do, according to Harvard University student Michael. Wow. At Kent State University, a professor freely calls his students his little jihadists and teaches them that Israel is the spiritual heir to Hitler. The same professor is on a terrorist watch list. It is not very reassuring to know he is being watched. Violent anti-Jewish, anti-Israel rallies have sent dozens of Jewish students to hospitals. Gideon of the University of Arizona relates that after he refused entry to his residence to someone whom he did not know and who had brought alcohol with him, he was faced a few minutes later with a gang of 20. Quote, "I was struck from behind and was unconscious," unquote. He says, "I was in a hospital for 3 weeks with a skull fracture and a concussion." His conclusion is frightening. Quote, "It is sad to see," he moans, That's it, sad. Anti-Jews, whites, blacks, Hispanics, Muslims, you name it, are cursing and physically attacking Jews and burning Israeli flags, and it's so sad. Is anyone listening? Campus officials utter empty statements condemning violence. Jewish leaders rant and rave, and violence continues. The Jewish press reported this week that one university suspected the Students for Justice for Palestinian group for 1 whole week for violating the civil rights of Jews. 1 week. SJP was reinstated because it promised to behave nicely. Put that in the items to remember folder. William Jacobson wrote a legal insurrection. We have posted many times about how the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement through Faculty and Students for Justice in Palestine branches has turned campuses and classrooms into political battlefields of the worst way. When Northwestern University SJP marches to the chant of "Long Live Intifada," they're celebrating the bloody suicide bombing campaign. When Vassar College SJP pickets a class and forces a professor to walk the gauntlet just because the course involved a trip to Israel, and anti-Israel students jeer Jewish students who spoke up for Israel. They're sending a message of continued conflict. So it was no surprise when Vassar SJP tweeted out a Nazi cartoon. Wow, man. They're picking on those guys. That's the end of that one. Looks like these people on the left are accomplishing more than the right wing has in 40 years, 50 years, 60 years. Well, I see Russian hackers attack millions of J.P. Morgan Chase bank accounts. Hackers working from deep inside Russia carried out one of the biggest cyber heists ever committed on American bank. Wow. Well, I found a Jew that's going to quit being a Jew, Professor Shlomo Sands, author of How and When I Stopped Being a Jew. For those who focus on these kinds of things, this is from the Jewish press. Shlomo Sands, who teaches contemporary history at the University of Tel Aviv, is along with Ilan Pop and a few lesser-known academics, the Jewish high priest of Israel hatred. Now, Sands is about to use the public platform provided by the London Middle East Institute and the Center for Jewish Studies at the University of London, SOAS, to hawk his new book, his talk entitled How I Stopped Being a Jew. Wow. Other loving books written by Pound, Professor Sand, include, quote, The Invention of the Jewish People and The Invention of the Land of Israel, unquote. The latest book is actually titled How and When I Stopped Being a Jew, but perhaps that didn't fit as well on the invitations to his lecture at SOAS. A loving review of Sand's latest book appears in the Arab Center for Research and Policy Studies, a part of the Doha Institute. According to this review, the book focuses on expounding upon Sand's view that Judaism is not a race, merely a missionary religion which aggregated to itself many different peoples and religions. In particular, Sand's focus on what he insists are racist values in Israel, and the growth of those same racist values even among secular Jews worldwide, quote, whose main role has been to reduce to justifying Israel's crimes against the Palestinians. Perhaps the most significant details which reveal what kind of country Israel is, one which values freedom of speech and expression, perhaps to a fault, is Shlomo Sands, professor of Israeli University, but the fawning reviewer of his book, Mahmoud Maharib, received his B.A. in political science from the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. There you go. A Jew-hating Jew. I've met a lot of those. Well, someone scrawled swastikas on the house of the historically Jewish fraternity Alpha Epsilon Pi at Emory University on Saturday, October 4th, just after the conclusion of Yom Kippur. By Monday, the fraternity had painted over the offensive graffiti, but administration officials at this university, located in Atlanta, Georgia, are actively conducting an investigation to determine who was responsible. Students interviewed about the incident were outraged, and some said they and their friends were wearing Israeli and Jewish symbols to show that what happened was not okay. Jews and other non-Jewish students showed solidarity with the fraternity against hatred. According to a statement obtained by the Business Insider, Emory President James Wagner sent the following email to the Emory University community on Sunday night. It saddens me to report that Alpha Epsilon Pi Fraternity House, an historically Jewish fraternity that doesn't believe in equality, evidently, here at Emory, was the target of crude, offensive graffiti, including swastikas, early Sunday morning, October 5th, shortly after the end of the observance of Yom Kippur. On behalf of our community, I denounce this abhorrent act. It is an offense against a Kike fraternity and a Jewish members of our community, and it's repugnant, flagrant emblem of anti-Jewism. It is also an offense against the entire university. Among the many pernicious things the swastika symbolizes, in the last century it represented the most egregious and determined undermining of intellectual freedom and truth-seeking. In short, its appearance on our campus is an attack against everything for which Emory stands. Emory University will not tolerate such acts. Well, I guess you did, because it happened. Instead, we must together pledge Emory University's continuing commitment to raise awareness and prevent all forms of violence and discrimination, to foster openness and diversity of thought, experience, and race, and culture. and to seek positive transformation in our community and the world. We all have a responsibility to uphold the principles we hold dear as an academic community and to create a community that's inclusive, race mix, open, race mix, respectful, race mix, and welcoming to all, race mix. Well, there you go. They're upset down there at Emory University. They're upset. Oh, boy, we got problems in Israel. Beitz Salem is a human rights NGO whose mission is to change Israeli policy in the occupied territories and ensure that its government, which rules the occupied territories, protects the human rights of residents there and complies with its obligations under international law as per the organization's website. Atef Abdu Arub, a field researcher for Beitz Salem, made headlines in Israel when an Israeli journalist released a video evidence of Arub denying the Holocaust took place. The Israeli journalist Tuvia Tenenbaum interviewed Arub as part of his research for his new book, Catch the Jew. At first, Beitz Salem responded to Tenenbaum's account, claiming that it was not an accurate summation of the facts and that Arub categorically denies the accusation and states that it is a falsehood and a misrepresentation of the interaction designed to damage Beitz Salem. However, on Sunday, October 5th, Beitz Salem released a statement on their Hebrew Facebook page, acknowledging that the video clearly shows Arub denying the Holocaust ever happened. Beitz Salem is careful to maintain the reliability and accuracy of its work and publication. Therefore, we promise to hold an inquiry as soon as possible into the incident, and we will publish the decision as soon as it's made, according to the Beitz Salem statement. Wow. What this inquiry will consist of was Arub's position on the organization. In the meantime, was not explained in the statement. Well, somebody there in Israel is right in the middle of Israel saying that there was no Holocaust. Wow. Okay, here's some KKK news. It makes sense that people are nervous about dealing with the police sometimes. Well, yeah. After all, they're just human beings like you or I. So you're never quite sure who you're dealing with. In fact, some could even belong to hateful white supremacist groups. A West Virginian police lieutenant was suspended for alleged KKK connections last week, and the fallout is still ongoing. Lieutenant Sean Williams, a 16-year veteran of the Charleston County Police Department, has been placed on paid administrative leave after investigators allegedly discovered videos on his computer containing racially insensitive content, as reports in by the Sunday Gazette Mail. Wow. Let me see here. And if it were possible to make the story any more troubling, the videos allegedly involved his daughter to boot. Oh, my God. According to the Sunday Gazette's Mail's Rusty Marks, who detailed the troubling story Wednesday, two sources claim that Williams' daughter was dressed up like a police officer in the offending video and that the anthem of the infamous racist group was playing in the background. While this is obviously still in the realm of allegation and the video isn't publicly available, the accounts depict a grim scene, a young girl dancing around to the song of one of the most reviled hate groups in American history, other than the Republican Party. According to Mark's sources, the lyrics repeated in the video sound pretty ambiguous. Wow. That's it. Run for your lives. The KKK cops are around. Yeah. This sounds a little familiar. It might be because another couple of police officers down in Florida got caught up in a similar scandal in July. Officers David Borst and George Honeywell, members of the Fruitland Park Police Department, both ended up leaving the force. Borst resigned. Honeywell was fired after a FBI report alleged there were KKK members. Huh. The story shook the Florida town to its core. Detailing by ABC News, Fruitland Park had a history of anti-black violence and KKK visibility through the 40s, 50s, 60s, and in 2009 another officer was fired for membership in the group. Borst, for the record, denied the allegations, while Honeywell's ex-wife claimed he was actually undercover. Wow. Well, you know what I say about that? I keep telling cops out there via this radio show, keep it underground, keep it lone wolf, keep your mouth shut, and tell your family, if they got to know, to keep their mouth shut too. Says here it'll be important to keep an eye on the exactly what transpires from here for Lieutenant Williams and the Charleston Police Department, considering the length of his tenure and the magnitude of bigotry that's more or less inherent to belonging to a group like the KKK. If it turns out not to be true in all cases throughout his 16 years that involve people of color are open to entirely fair scrutiny for racial bias. In short, this could be a big mess for all involved. Yeah, they'll probably turn all the people that he arrested, they'll probably turn them loose. Let them out of prison, man. Come on. You can't keep the darkies in the prison. In short, alleged right-wingers can't keep their mouth shut. Guy's 16 years on the force, and he's letting it leak out. He's got connection to the Klan. You don't want any connection with the Klan. Stop it. Shut your pie hole. Pretend you're a race mixer, and you love the Negroes, and you love the Jews, and you love anybody that hates whites. Yeah. Oh, well, I guess having a few guys like this out there, there's nothing you can do about it. They don't listen to you, so let them take the heat. Keeps the heat off us, right? Right. Makes sense to me. Well, those vicious neo-Nazis have vandalized an exhibition in New York City. Mustafa Hadyaya of Hyperallergenic reports that last Friday morning, three individuals vandalized works in a photography show titled Material Evidence, installed at 540 West 21st Street. They also left leaflets containing anti-Putin and neo-Nazi slogans and imagery. Now, you see, that's where it's coming from, that they believe that these people are really National Socialists fighting for the wrong people over there in the Ukraine. Because if it's anti-Putin and neo-Nazi, you know which side they're on. And pepper spraying the curator of the exhibition, Benjamin Hiller. The defacing of works and confrontation with the curator allegedly centered around photographs in one section of the installation addressing the current civil conflict in the Ukraine. The exhibition contains the work from a group of Russian, Ukrainian, French, and Spanish photojournalists, along with physical artifacts from the conflict areas of Syria and Ukraine. Hiller is a freelance photojournalist and writer and was appointed curator by the group. The exhibition will remain on display with increased security through October 11th. Well, that's some of those neo-Nazis that are supporting the Kiev government and the billionaires and the Jews behind it. I guess so. Oh, man.
Of investigative stories I did for mainstream journalism was a series called Dark Alliance, which I wrote for the San Jose Mercury News in 1996. And what Dark Alliance was about was a story about drug trafficking in the ghettos of Los Angeles and who was bringing the drugs in, and the fact that the American Central Intelligence Agency was indirectly profiting from this drug trade and knew about it and did nothing to stop it. And what my stories main point was that it was this drug activity at that point in time that kicked off the crack epidemic in the 1980s. So that was a three-part series. We had a website, and it kicked up a shitstorm.
Excellent. What was that shitstorm?
Well, I think the first revelation was that that crack happened in South Central LA for a very specific reason, rather than what was currently thought, was that crack just happened everywhere at once and it was just black people and they couldn't say no. And what my story showed was that the cocaine that was being sold in those neighborhoods was coming from mainly one source, and this one source was being used to finance a guerrilla war in Central America. And we showed it very conclusively that that was the case. And a lot of people, a lot of newspapers, then drew the conclusion that we were accusing the CIA of touching off the crack epidemic, which wasn't exactly what we were saying, but the general idea of the CIA dealing drugs was something that the American mainstream press had never written about before. And that's why it was such an outrageous story and a scandalous story. And the fact that we showed what happened as a result of this, which was crack in black neighborhoods. So it was an outrageous story. I mean, I admit it, but it was true. And that's why it prompted outrage among blacks, among drug reform activists, among politicians, by the CIA, by every federal agency involved in the drug war, because it showed they weren't doing their jobs, that it was a fraud.
Was from narconews.com, and I happen to know about this, knew about it long before he made this documentary, because we had men, like I've told you before, shadowing and spying on MENA Airport down in Arkansas when Bill Clinton was still just a governor. He knew all about it. They're downloading the drugs from CIA planes, MENA Airport. One of our men lost his life because of it. And but they won't do anything about it. You know, Reagan was up to his ears in it. Oliver North, who's back on TV blowing off, he was involved up to his ears and should have been in prison. Reagan should have been impeached. It was interfering in the internal affairs of Nicaragua. So anyhow, that's the story there, and it pretty much details the connection between politicians and the drug trade and the CIA. And it goes on and on with not really any fear of it being exposed. I mean, it's exposed, but nobody's going to do anything about it. Because in reality, there's only one thing that can be done about it. I'll let you guess what that is. A lot of right-wingers out there will say, oh, that's wonderful because they're giving it to the blacks. But they spread that stuff all over the country. Plenty of white people got into that. Plenty of white addicts, too. So if you're thinking it's wonderful just because they got it going in the ghetto, well, think twice. Many times they try out things in the ghetto, and then it moves out from there. And, of course, where did all the money go? Where did all the money go? It was CIA and CIA-connected people getting the money from the drug purchases in the ghetto. Where'd it go? You have the filthiest, rottenest system, I believe, it's ever existed on the face of the earth. Most systems, if they're rotten, are right out in the open with it. Yeah, this is what we did. If you don't like it, we'll kill you. But not these people. They attempt to keep it secret. But even when it becomes non-secret, nobody ever pays the price. Nobody ever pays. Oliver North gets on television, I tempted to put my foot through the screen. Goddamn Republican neocons, they worship Reagan like he was the second coming of Jesus Christ. I mean, that's what's maddening. They worship the worst people. Name highways, airports, everything after Ronald Reagan. It's ridiculous. And if you're a selective bargain guy and a union guy and any of that stuff, and you worshiped Ronald Reagan, you got to be doubly out of your mind. If you don't know about that, go back and study what he did to Patco, the airport people who guided the airplanes in. I forget the name of them, but anyhow, I can't believe it how people worship people who do everything they can against laboring white people. Anyhow, all this truth comes out all over the internet. There's more truth comes out on the internet than any place else, but what changes? Nothing changes. Oh, everybody says, oh, that's bad. That's too bad. They're bad guys. But that's it. Nothing changes.
Tablet, it's me, Sarah Ivory. I'm your host. Today, we're going off-road just a little bit. Recently, I heard a radio program that riveted me. It was all about defense lawyers. The thing about defense lawyers is that when the accused seem to be innocent, we cheer the defense lawyers on as if they're heroes. But if it looks at all like the accused person is in fact guilty of a crime, and especially if it's a case that was violent or gruesome, we find ourselves asking, how on earth can that lawyer, in good faith, represent that accused person? Erica Heilman wondered this herself. She's the producer of a radio program called Rumble Strip Vermont. And for a recent episode, that episode that I heard, she talked to 5 different defense attorneys about why they do the work that they do and how it affects them. Today, we're listening to a modified version of that piece. Our story features just one lawyer. His name is Richard Rubin. Here's his story. Chapter 1. Why do you do it?
What really got me into public defense was kind of an interest in representing poor people. So what I wanted to do was provide the most aggressive, competent defense for people with no money as we could provide. And the odds are stacked against you. Juries don't like criminal defendants. There's a presumption of guilt. Most clients are not middle class, don't present well in court, don't look great in court. And they're facing middle-class, suspicious juries who know that they're there because they did something wrong. The juries don't trust the defense attorneys a lot. So, you know, you can win, and we do win. But more often than not, we lose.
Chapter 2, The Art of Criminal Defense.
It's like putting on a play. It's theater. You're telling a story. It's a narrative that you're trying to create an impression in a story through the witnesses, through your presentation and the whole gestalt of the trial. So if you were going to put on My Fair Lady on Broadway, you'd need more than one rehearsal. You need to have a script and a narrative and work with the players that are available to you to tell the story. So that starts at the very first moment you get the case. You really need to know who the players are, what happened, what variations on stories you can tell. I mean, you could just imagine a 3-day trial with 20 witnesses, or any experience you've had personally, where you've been somewhere at a meeting for 3 hours. You don't remember what anybody said. Maybe if you've taken notes, you might remember. But, you know, at the end of the meeting, you just kind of remember that John Smith was smart. Susie was good looking. John, I can't believe a thing he had to say because he was a jerk and was pompous. Someone else was sophisticated and lovely and intelligent and talked in complete sentences, and I'd like to spend more time with him. But at the end of it, you kind of have like this, there's been a consensus reached about what the group is going to do. But you kind of don't remember who or why or how it got there. Same thing as with the trial. You know, when the trial ends, there's kind of like, oh, well, what are we going to do here? I guess he didn't really mean to kill him. Or maybe the victim deserved it. Whatever the theme is, if you've done it right, that's what ends up happening. So your role is kind of as the conductor. And if you can be relaxed and honest and open with the jurors, they can see bullshit. They don't even know they're seeing bullshit, but the group of 12 people has a very high bullshit meter. I mean, so even though you're telling a story that may be only 80% true or 60% true, you know, someone once said about lawyers, once you can fake sincerity, the rest of it is easy. So it's like that.
Chapter 3, The Cross-Examination.
People have said about cross-examinations, the jurors only consider one thing. Who won? Was it the lawyer or the witness? So, you know, the state puts on a ballistics guy. That's maybe not a great example. The state is going to put on some accident reconstruction person who's going to explain in a kind of mushy science how something happened. Your job is to make the person look like an idiot, right? He doesn't know what he's doing, or he's got an axe to grind, or he's biased, or he's sloppy, or he didn't do the job, or he's, you know. So at the end of this hour-long cross-examination, the jurors conclude, this guy's a jerk. This guy's didn't do his job. And that's the art of cross-examination. It's to control the witness, and in the nicest of ways, right? And it's like, you know, you don't. No one likes the lawyer to be a bully either. So, you know, you have to be nice and pleasant and clear and direct. And at the end of it, if you've been able to control the witness, the guy looks like an idiot. Well, that's an art. And it often doesn't happen. But when it happens, it's like one of the greatest thrills in the courtroom.
Chapter 4, The State of Vermont versus Clifford Messier.
So Clifford Messier was a young man up in Orleans County who worked at the Ethan Allen Furniture Mill. And he, at age 16, married a 13-year-old woman, and he was obsessed with her. I mean, he had a dependent personality disorder. He was totally obsessed with her. And so, of course, she got older. She was completely trapped in this relationship. And they had a child, and then they had another child. So by the time she was 17, I think she had two children, and she started to mess around and go out with other guys, and Clifford, who was weak and dependent and spent more on his car payments than he did on his rent, would always take her back. But one time she met this guy named Lucian Blodgett, and she decided that she was going to leave him. This was it. He was like 21, she was 17, 18 at the time. So, and this time she's going to take the kids with her. So it was going to happen on a particular Sunday, and Saturday night he says to her, can we go out to the dance at the Elks Club? There's a dance and one last night to go out together. And she said, oh, shit, all right. So they went out and they danced and they get back, and it's 11:30 or 12 at night, and they're in bed, and Lucian calls and says, where the hell are you? You know, you're supposed to call me so I know what time you're going to meet me tomorrow. And Clifford is lying in bed, and he says, don't be talking to him. And Caroline says, shut up, and slaps him. And Clifford goes downstairs. He gets the gun. The bullets are in one in the closet. He gets the gun. He loads the gun. He gets in his Camaro. He drives a half a mile down to Orleans Center. Gets out. Lucian is on the phone at a payphone, talking to Caroline. He says, I got to get off the phone. Clifford's here. Clifford takes the gun out, lays it across the top of his car, and shoots Lucian dead in the head. And then he goes back to the house, and he says to Caroline, I just shot Lucian. And she, of course, goes nuts. And then he goes to a friend's house, an older man's house, and sits there and waits till the cops come and arrest him. So he's charged with first-degree murder. Because he got the gun and he went out and he intentionally, you know, shot the lover. Sounds like a fairly clean case of first-degree murder. Well, our job was to tell a different story. It had to be a different narrative. The narrative was he couldn't help himself. He was mentally ill. He was a dependent personality disorder. The thought of Caroline leaving him made it impossible for him to do anything other than what he did, and he was less culpable, and the defense was insanity, that he was mentally ill, and that he couldn't conform his conduct to the requirements of the law. So we had to get a psychiatrist to come and interview him and develop this whole narrative of who he was, who she was, what their relationship was, who their family members were. We had to get Caroline to switch sides, in other words, to become, because she was the witness. It was her story as well as his, so she had to step up. And she did. She stepped up and explained how poor Clifford was the dependent. You know, this was poor Clifford. So we were able to tell this story to the jury, and the story of the trial was wonderful. And it told that we had 11 French-Canadian women and one guy who was basically not playing any role. And they just embraced Clifford's story. So we had the trial, and we never expected to win entirely, but the jury came back with manslaughter. The judge ultimately gave Clifford 2 years to serve. He'd already been in about 6 months, so he had to serve another 18 months. He allowed him to serve his sentence in the county jail in Newport, go to work during the day, come back after work to serve his sentence at the jail, and then he gave him Sunday afternoons off to spend with his children. And so it was a victory, but he was convicted, and it was the right decision, you know, from my point of view. Of course, I mean, the jury got it right. You want to have juries? They find people not guilty? Screw you. The jury's right. You know? You know, wait till you're charged with a crime, you know, and the jury finds you not guilty. Then you won't be so cynical about what juries do. You know, when my client gets a good deal, especially from a jury, I say, great, because most juries are in there ready to convict. I mean, they're there like, okay, what did this guy do? One of the things the job has given me over the years is the ability or the necessity to go out into the community and meet people whose lives have intersected with my clients, the clients themselves, their families, their employers, all different people, all different kinds of people, because they're all different. My clients have committed all kinds of crimes, or they've been injured and they've had all different experiences. So I've had to get off my ass, get in my car, and drive up to St. Johnsbury or Walcott or, you know, Vershire or other places, or go down to Randolph and meet someone's employer at a small factory and talk to his co-workers about who he is and who his family is, and sit in people's living rooms and talk to them about their lives and their experiences and meet their grandmothers and their children. And walk into homes where there's no heat except for wood stoves, and poor people and middle class people, in ways that made me really understand where I'm living and what I'm part of, right? And that's why I'm here. That's kind of what I defined about why I wanted to be a lawyer. I wanted that kind of connection with people. You know, so this job has enabled me to have those connections, not only with the people, but the places in which they live. So I just remember that Clifford Messier case that I mentioned up in the Northeast Kingdom. And I remember driving up into the... because all of the witnesses were all over Orleans County and Craftsbury and Orleans and Coventry and Irisburg and places like that. And it was... a lot of the work I did was in the winter. It was in, you know, November, December, January, February. Let's talk about bleak. I mean, people don't come to Vermont in November and March. I mean, they don't understand. You know, as my wife says, what do we live in? What's this about? You know, it's so horrible here. And I just remember driving up, you know, in mud season into, you know, back roads in Irisburg to go to some broken down farmhouse, and I loved it. I loved it.
Ben, he lives and works in central Vermont. Today's podcast is an excerpt from a longer episode by Erica Heilman called The Defense. It aired on her program Rumble Strip Vermont.
Well, that's sort of interesting about a defense attorney. I'm sure it would have been a lot different if you'd have heard it from a defense attorney in L.A. I got to know several of them and talk about cynical and so forth and understanding how rotten the cops are and all that kind of stuff and everybody else. You need to talk to an L.A. defense attorney. I don't know how they can do it. I don't know how they can do it every day. Well, that's it about that's it for now. I'll be back tomorrow on Tuesday, and we'll see what's cooking then. So in the meantime, 14-5, and shot your paho. Be like the cops and blab and blab and lose your career. No matter what you're doing, if you've got a good job, you got a career, you got to keep your mouth shut. And that's the only way you'll survive.
Today, we're all going to learn a new term. It's only two words. Now listen closely. Can all of you say constructive fraud?
Constructive fraud!
Did you ever get the feeling as you're staring at the ceiling that this game of life is playing fair? Seems as fast as we can make it, there's a hand that grabs and takes it till they find us in a grave somewhere. Like a rodent on a treadmill, we keep pushing for it uphill, but we never seem to get too far. Well, if you think you're being taken, then you're ready to awaken to the truth of what we really are. We're all indentured, servitudal slaves, overburdened and bewildered, feudal knaves, who have lost our soul posterity through ignorance and apathy, and now we're being taxed out of our graves. And as long as we stay passive, we'll succumb, contented with some socialistic crumb. Well, the naked truth and fact is we're all saps who pay our taxes, and that is why the banksters keep us dumb. Could the state of our condition be the product of omission, what we didn't learn in public schools? And did our fathers all through history all fight and die for liberty so we could play the tyrant's fools? And can you call it education when it's all indoctrination to obey the hidden powers that be? Did we fight the revolution? Did we win the world wars just to slumber into slavery? We're all indentured, servitudal slaves, overburdened and bewildered, feudal knaves, who have lost our soul posterity through ignorance and apathy, and now we're being taxed out of our graves. And as long as we stay passive, we'll succumb, contented with some humanistic crumb. Well, the naked truth and fact is we're all saps who pay those taxes, and that is why the banksters keep us dumb. While Franklin and Eleanor were telling us they hated war, they made a deal behind our back. They said the bankers could enslave us for a portion of our wages, and today we call it income tax. But what they failed then to tell us was the way they planned to sell us into statutory slavery. Now it's called constructive fraud. Some even claim the wrath of God. I call it social insecurity. Let's stop being indentured, servitudal slaves, overburdened and bewildered, feudal knaves, and reclaim our lost posterity. Rise up and proclaim liberty. It's high time we rock the boat and make some waves. 'Cause as long as we stay passive, we'll succumb. They'll starve us on their communistic crumb. And the naked truth and fact is we don't have to pay those taxes. Yes, it's time we show those banksters